Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. On these podcasts, we talk to guests who have experienced harm from extreme religious beliefs, as well as experts who offer help, hope, and healing. And sometimes these people are one and the same. I am your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett. We today have a very special guest on our episode today, Yvette Cantu-Snyder, who is the former policy analyst for the Family Research Council. So we're going to jump right into her interview and her story pretty quickly, but I do want to set the stage a little bit before we start. The Family Research Council was established as the political arm of Focus on the Family by James Dobson in 1981, just 2 years after the founding of the Moral Majority by Jerry Falwell Sr. And what both of these groups have in common is that they are part of what is known as the religious right or the Christian right. These are conservative, usually fundamentalist Christians who influence national laws with their specific view and interpretation of the Bible, primarily related to their view of morality. So I say primarily just because they have very strong views now on things like the relationship with Israel and lately even how we treat immigrants. The rise to power happened over a period of about 50 years and began on the issue of desegregation. And this is a popular misconception that the religious right came together to fight abortion, but that was actually a secondary battle and more of a red herring. Before 1979, most Christian fundamentalists actually held pro-choice positions. And this was also documented in a number of places, including my book, Rethinking Everything. It was 6 years after the Roe v. Wade decision that they took up the pro-life battle. And what really upset the leaders of the religious right was when Jimmy Carter in 1976 threatened to remove federal funding from their private Christian schools unless they integrated them. While that was the catalyst for uniting the religious right, it was a man by the name of Paul Weyrich, who was a Republican political strategist who made it all happen. And our guest was interviewed by Weyrich upon her arrival at the Family Research Council, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. But Paul Weyrich had been trying to get fundamentalists to vote because they were an untapped block of voters who believed they should focus on winning souls rather than having their hand in politics, rather than focusing on the state of worldly affairs. Weyrich is credited for helping to found a number of political religious right organizations to push the corporate Republican agenda by using moral issues and backing of conservative Christians who support them. So the point of this is not so much about the political agenda as it is the ideologies that drive it. If we look at the statistics of these 70.6% of self-identified Christians in the United States today, only 25.4% identify as evangelicals. And what this means is that they represent about 17% of the U.S. population, yet they are in positions to determine the moral and policy decisions for all of us. We're not going to discuss how we got here today. We will talk about this in future episodes. But we want to listen to one person's experience with the religious right and what eventually led her to question and leave the Christian organization she once led and even one that she founded. So with that, let me say welcome to Yvette.
Thank you, Tim and Bill. Thank you for having me.
Yes, we are so glad you are here. And Bill, do you want to give the honor of introducing Yvette?
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about her. She is an accomplished author and public speaker. She studied comparative religion at the University of Delhi in India, and she holds a bachelor's degree in English from the University of California at Irvine. As Tim mentioned, she was a policy analyst with the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C., and in that role, she appeared on national TV shows such as The O'Reilly Factor, Religion and Ethics, Newsweekly, NBC's Viewpoint, and The Crier Report. She's spoken to college campuses across the country and as well as at various conferences and before state and national legislatures. She was also an advisor for Athletes in Action and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and she was the director of women's ministry at the now defunct Exodus International. Following her painful journey out of fundamentalism, she's been interviewed by the Southern Poverty Law Center, Time Magazine, and other media outlets, and her articles have appeared in national newsletters. She's the author of a book about her personal change, as well as a soon-to-be-released novel that she's written. So Yvette, I also want to thank you so much for being our guest. You and I have been virtual friends for several years. I read your first book and was so impacted by your story. I don't want to shatter my well-crafted macho image, but I was moved to tears several times reading it. And I even kind of became a fanboy and was sharing excerpts after excerpts from your book on my Facebook page. And so later in the show, if there's time, I definitely want to talk about your book. So thank you so much for being with us. It's our honor to have you here.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate your kind words as well.
It means a lot. Based on what we've just shared, you have a pretty impressive fundamentalism pedigree. Did you grow up in the church?
No, I didn't. I grew up Catholic. We were nominally Catholic. I was baptized and I was confirmed, but we never really talked about God at home, ever. It was just something you did on Sundays. And we lived in a very Catholic community, so it's what everyone did on Sundays. It was just, you know, like watching football on Sundays, something you did.
In your role with the policy analyst for the Family Research Council, not everybody is familiar with that organization. So you can you tell us a little bit about who they are and what they do?
Well, when I was there, you know, I want to specify that by saying when I was there, because it seems like they are a bit different these days and a bit more strident than when I was there. But we dealt with, in my department, I was part of cultural studies. And so my department in particular dealt with social issues. Some of the other departments dealt with things pertaining to government, things pertaining to family, but mine was only dealing with cultural issues. And by cultural issues, I mean things like condoms, condom usage. That was a big thing, funnily enough. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, gay marriage, hate crimes. Is there a gay gene? Things like that.
I've followed the organization for years and write about them. They are, of all the organizations that are involved in the religious right, this group, the Family Research Council, they are unapologetically both religious and political. Every year they host the Values Voters Summit. How did you get involved with them?
You know, it's interesting, though, that you say that they're unapologetically religious, because I came from, when I became a Christian, I became a non-denominational, evangelical, speaking in tongues, that sort of thing. That was not the type of person I ran into when I started working for Family Research Council. And that's the exact type of person I thought I would run into. There were actually very few there who were like me. Most of them were not charismatic. There were definitely many, many from denominations. Baptists and Catholics were probably the most predominant. And then you know, the non-denominational types who don't believe in the gifts of the Spirit and speaking in tongues. So I thought that was interesting when I got there. Hmm.
Did you pursue working with them because of your religious beliefs or because of your political beliefs?
No, you know, that's an interesting question, because it seems like these days your political beliefs go hand in hand with your religious beliefs.
Absolutely.
So I really couldn't separate the two. It's almost like if you secretly believed something politically that someone else didn't, you just kept your mouth shut. And I actually heard people say that, well, I don't really believe that, so I'm just not going to say anything. But the way I got started was I was speaking at an event in Orange County, California, and called Christian Outreach Week. And I spoke about, you know, coming out of homosexuality, then coming out of the closet into Jesus's arms, I think is what I called it. And the woman sitting in the front row, these meetings were held at people's homes. So this was at a person's home. And I was very nervous. I had never done anything like this before. I didn't really know what I was going to say. So I planned and planned and planned. And I got up there and I spoke, and the woman sitting right up in front was very flashily dressed, very colorful. And after I finished, she said, "What would you think about relocating to Washington, D.C.?" Well, I didn't really believe her. I didn't think that she had any, like, this seems pretty much like a rhetorical question. But anyway, I said, "Yeah, I would. I'd think about it." And the next thing you know, what I didn't know was that she was on the board. She was on the board of Family Research Council, and she was on the board of Focus on the Family. So at the same time that I was interviewing with Family Research Council, who had me come in an interview because they saw a video of the talk I had given in Orange County. And the people at Focus had too. So they were offering me a job at the same time, but I went with Family Research Council because I was more interested in the political side at that point.
Okay. What were your responsibilities with the Family Research Council?
Mostly I spoke, like you mentioned, on college campuses. I spoke at conferences. I was one of the first speakers at Focus's Love One Out conferences. I wrote papers. I wrote policy papers. I spoke whenever any issues relating to homosexuality at all, but also like sexually transmitted diseases. I would speak on that. And I would do TV shows, radio shows. So just sort of as a spokesperson, more than a policy analyst. I mean, I did write papers, but mostly I was out speaking, and even in your state, Bill, Texas.
I can't imagine Texas wanting anybody politically conservative speaking.
this was to do with hate crimes legislation.
Oh yeah,
and actually, I was in the minority there when I was asked to come and speak. I was asked by, what's the name of the organization? It's a pro-family organization, and it has different chapters in different states. So the head of the chapter in Texas asked me to come. And there was a Senate hearing, and the other side was packed.
Wow.
And the people who didn't want... who wanted the hate crimes legislation. And of course I was on the side opposing it, and they had everyone from law enforcement to members of the community. James Byrd's family was up in front in the front row. Remember him?
Yes.
You know, the black man who was dragged in a truck behind a truck by a couple of guys and ended up killing him, of course. His family was there. And I spoke on the opposing side, and I was one of two or three speakers when they had probably 100. We were there for hours and hours and hours.
Right.
So, Yvette, can I ask why? Why were they opposed to hate crime legislation?
Because it was, okay, what I would say was that it creates a hierarchy of victims. And then you're saying that some people are more important than others. So when I identified as a lesbian, if I had been killed, my life would have been more meaningful then and deserving of more of someone who had killed me, raped me, whatever, would be deserving of more punishment than if they did it now when I'm a heterosexually married woman.
And that would be bad because?
And that would be bad because it would make a certain group of people more important than another group and create that hierarchy of victims.
So they didn't see that as justice. They just saw it as hierarchy.
Right. Like, no, if everyone's lives are equal, then why should there be greater punishment when one person is harmed than when another person is harmed?
Yeah. And I think you mentioned James Byrd, and I think that in that time period, his murder added a different face to the whole issue, because many people wanted to just make it a gay or lesbian issue. And James made it more than that. I mean, he was brutally attacked. He was murdered simply because he was a Black man.
Yep. Yep. And so that was my argument as a policy analyst for Family Research Council. The argument was, you are creating a hierarchy of victims. And it did not pass that year.
No.
It didn't. It passed in subsequent years, but not that year. That was right before George Bush was going to run for president. And so everyone would joke with me that, oh, hate crimes legislation didn't end up on his desk, and he has you to thank for that. You should get a night in the Lincoln bedroom, which of course I didn't. But, but you know, it's interesting, because when I was reading your book, Tim, so much of it, Rethinking Everything, that book, so much of it resonated with me, because I probably fell into every single category that you described of why people believe certain things and then what pushes them over and why they don't. Because right before that hearing, I was in the bathroom, you know, just kind of, I knew my time was coming up, just sort of collecting myself. And I thought, do I even really believe this? But it's too late now. Like, I have to go out there and I have to say this. I have to play my part. But is this really what I believe? Like, that was one of the first times that there was a conscious thought. I think I had subconscious thoughts all along that I didn't let seep into my consciousness. But this was the first conscious thought. Why am I doing this? Do I even believe this?
What was it like when you were at Family Research Council working with everyone? Was the atmosphere charged with, we have this passion to do God's work? What was the thinking, and what were the personal conversations that happened?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was like. It was very charged. It was very exciting. Yes, it doesn't look like things are going our way, but God always wins, you know, so we can't get discouraged, because God has this under control. That was the atmosphere. It's like, yes, this is all about, you know, we're doing God's work. We're doing this for God, regardless of what our denominational beliefs are. We can definitely rally around homosexuality is wrong. That obviously was a big one. Abortion is wrong. Everyone can agree with that. You would be crazy not to. That was the attitude.
And what did you see among the leadership? Was it very political? Were they brazenly political and religious, as Bill was talking about earlier? Or was that kind of an undertone?
Everyone was very political. This was definitely an organization that, from the inside, listening to people talk, it was political first. It was definitely political first. It may have been charged by people's religious beliefs, but it was mostly political. And the conversations that went on inside were political. There was very, other than, you know, God's in control and everything will work out okay, there wasn't a lot of talk about God. And sometimes it was embarrassing if people would talk about God. I remember, you know, when you were introducing me and you were talking about Paul Weyrich, his was actually the very first show that I went on, the very first day that I worked there. And I don't remember a whole lot about it, except I do remember he wanted to know how I got there. So I was talking about basically my testimony and Jesus. I think I said the word Jesus even. And he was very embarrassed by that. And I could see him just trying to push me in a different direction, which I thought was very interesting.
And I think that as I followed Family Research, and of course, they've got this new arm they call Family Research Council Action Arm, where they've moved in. I mean, it is almost predominantly political. They're the organization that hosts the annual Values Voter Summit, and they bring in politicians, and they try to downplay the religious dimension of it.
Yes.
That it's purely about voters. It's purely about our values. It's about family. They use the word family values repeatedly. As I said, I've written about this a couple of times on my blog. They've had candidate Trump and they had President Trump. But when you look at their list of speakers, you know, Kirk Cameron and Dynasty, Phil Robertson and some of these people. I mean, it really is seriously religious in the guise of politics, but they're so powerful. And you were talking about when you were there and the attitude that we're just not, you know, maybe it's not going our way. I just have to wonder what it's like now when it does seem to be going their way. I mean, they have a president, they have an administration that is backing their values and their agenda. So it's got to feel really good being them right now.
I'm sure they feel absolutely triumphant because you're going in with Trump, counting on him to get you your Supreme Court picks. He did exactly that. I mean, what they want more than anything is the Supreme Court. So you're getting two ultra-conservative picks. You couldn't ask for anything better. So yes. if Trump goes down after this, I honestly think they wouldn't care. So they'd think, well, we got what we wanted from him. Who cares? His time's up.
I definitely think that the many in the religious right and the fundamentalists, if you got them to be totally honest with you, they would say they don't approve of the behavior, they don't approve of the morality, but they really don't care because it is moving forward their agenda to take over the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I don't see any of my conservative friends who I formerly worked with at Family Research Council and other organizations openly supporting Trump. They won't say anything openly like that. So they're not saying, oh, yes, you know, he's God's chosen one. They're not saying that, at least to me. But what they are happy about is that he's doing what they want him to do.
Exactly. He talks about religious freedom and passes executive
orders.
Yeah, executive orders about religious freedom and religious liberty and proclaims national days of prayer, those kinds of things. And I think that's like red meat being thrown to them. They like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's an element they don't like, which is the buffoonery, but they're just going to ignore that.
Right. And I've had friends of mine who are very, very conservative religiously and politically will tell me, well, I don't like some of his behavior, but God is able to work through anything. God is able to work past that. God is able to use him. And so there is kind of an acquiescence to overlooking this behavior.
Oh, yeah. You know, God can use a donkey, so God can use whoever he chooses.
Exactly.
What I find interesting, though, is the ideologies that we hold on to so tightly, and we make all of these excuses around them. You know, one of the things you said to me about a long time ago or a while back was with the ex-gay movement is that they saw ex-gays as a necessary evil.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because you had, what was the 1964 Civil Rights Act? And when analysts looked at it afterwards and said, okay, let's look and see who would actually be covered in the Civil Rights Act. And it would be people who had been underrepresented politically, people who had immutable characteristics, people who had lower earning levels. Okay, so those are the three standards. And where would gay people fall into that? Well, they would be underrepresented politically. Because, I mean, they did fall under that category. They did fall under not earning as much. But the conservative right found ways of saying, well, when you aren't identified as a group yet, how, of course, you're not going to be represented politically. And there were ways around the two arguments. The one argument that was difficult was, do you have an immutable characteristic? So when it came to the Civil Rights Act, it was, okay, we have to prove that gay people, that this is mutable, that they can be changed. So that's where ex-gay ministries came in. It's like, well, where can we find people who have changed? And even though these people are somewhat embarrassing, and a lot of these, especially the men who seem like they still are gay, but we have to just believe them and say that they aren't because we need them. We need to convince people that this is a changeable characteristic so they won't be included in all of these benefits you get from the Civil Rights Act.
So in the inevitable, when they started to come into their own and realize that they were truly gay, they dismissed it.
Right. I mean, I still see people like, you know, some of those, what's Narth now? What's their new name?
Oh, reintegrative therapy.
Well, what's, yeah, that's
sorry.
Reintegrative therapy to, right. So that they won't be linked anymore with reparative therapy or conversion therapy, even though, come on, we all know it's the exact same thing.
Right. Right.
You can call it by any name. We know what it is, but it's the new name of NARTH, the Something Alliance. And they're still putting out, oh, we did this study or we found this study of these people who think therapy has benefited them. It's very vague like that.
Yes.
And it's all, you know, people that, like we used to be, you know, people
right,
that showed up to Exodus conferences and we really want to change. And we tell everyone we have, because that's what we're supposed to do as good Christians.
And we're supposed to accept those personal testimonies at face value. And I've always been very resistant to that and written about it extensively of, you know, why am I supposed to just accept somebody says I was gay and now I'm not, any more than I could accept. I was in an elevator several years ago with a woman, and we were just all riding up in the elevator, and she looked around and she says, an angel came by my house last night and took me, flew me all around the world and showed me the earth and told me this and that. And I was like, okay. So I wonder why I'm supposed to believe somebody says I was gay and I'm not, any more than I believe this woman was carried by an angel around the world. They're self-reporting, self-diagnostic, but there's no evidence. There's no verifiable proof of it. I'm not going to argue with their experience, but the reality is you can't prove that.
Well, I mean, and that goes for religion in general. I mean, there is no proof one way or the other. So it's all subjective experience.
Right. Exactly. Yvette, do you keep up with what, I mean, when you got out of family research and you got out of this kind of right-wing fundamentalism, do you still keep up with it? Are you involved in politics and maybe just watching them? Do you keep up with them?
Not too much. No, not really. Okay. I wouldn't say not at all, but
right.
Not enough.
I was just curious as to how you responded to it. Cause I know that it could be very triggering to, yeah. to keep up with it too much, going, oh my God, I can't believe they're saying that.
Very triggering. So that's why.
Well, I think what we do is when we leave it, we think, oh my gosh, that was me. I can't believe I said that.
Yes. Yes.
Exactly. Then I'd rather not be reminded.
Right. Exactly. Right.
And there's always people in our past who can remind us and do remind us. Well, you know, I have tapes of me in the past when I was a fundamentalist pastor, and people will send me these tapes, or they'll send me articles that I wrote for conservative Christian magazines. And they'll say, do you remember you said this? Why are you saying something different now?
Which I always think is crazy. It's like, are people not allowed to change where you are when you're 18 years old is where you're supposed to be when you're 68 years old? You're always supposed to have the exact same views and say the exact
exactly.
same things. That's what I don't understand at all.
Well, and it's the same thing when I talk to people today, especially in gay, the gay community, when somebody who is a prominent spokesman for like the conversion therapy or reparative therapy or what I call ex-gay, when they come out and they say, you know, I was wrong. I now admit that what I was doing was wrong, and I'm embracing myself as a gay person or as a lesbian. And then people in the gay community just want to just beat them up. And so we don't allow anybody the room or the freedom to change their opinion. We condemn them when they have these opinions. And then when they change their opinion, we still condemn them.
Yeah, it makes
sense. So it's a no-win, damned if I do, damned if I don't scenario.
Yeah, so may as well stay with the people who like you and embrace you, right?
Yeah,
and find
exactly.
a way to just keep living that way.
We don't give them, we don't let them know that it's safe for you to do this.
It's scary to leave what you know. It's scary to leave right. who you've always been.
Yes.
So can you, nice segue, can you kind of talk about what was your journey out? I mean, your book is very interesting, which is Never Not Broken. It's a very interesting journey. And you're going from this fundamentalist church to this spiritual realm of, you know, the meditation that you were doing. Kind of explain what that journey was like.
Well, you know, we had been living in the Midwest and then we moved here to the West. And it was shortly after that, less than a year, when my youngest daughter was diagnosed with leukemia. And I always say that that was really the turning point, even though I had had doubts for years and years. This, you know, it was this cataclysmic event that really shook me up. And it shook me up in every way that you can be shaken up, because we had always been healthy. I didn't think that any child of mine was going to get that kind of sick, you know, a sore throat and strep throat, but not leukemia, not cancer. And when that happened, I had an opportunity that I probably never would have had otherwise, which was to just step away from it all. At the time, I was the director of women's ministry for Exodus. I took a leave of absence and I just had time to myself for once. And then the church we were going to, which we had already in the church that we had been to previously uncovered incredible corruption, which was part of the church movement. I'm being vague because I don't want to say the name, had been part of the church movement that I had been in from the start. So to find out that everything was corrupt was very hard for me, because then it's like, well, these are the people that I have been listening to actually teach me the Bible. And now I find out that I can't really believe anything they say because of how corrupt they've been. Then we went to several churches here. We went to one for 6 months and we were tithing to them. My daughter gets sick. I'm having terrible problems with anxiety and panic. So Paul, my husband, goes to the pastor, to one of the elders, and says, you know, my wife's really not doing well. My daughter's not doing well. And their response was, oh, we'll pray for you. We'll pray for you. I mean, the Bible says that you're supposed to come to our house and pray over us and sort of minister to us. That never happened. And it was at that point when I said, that's it. I'm not going anymore. That was the straw that broke the camel's back for me in terms of actually being involved with church, where you go from those that are corrupt to those that won't even follow a simple biblical guideline, which is, and to people who are actually giving you 10% of their paycheck, and you're not going to just get a couple of the guys who are elders to come out and talk to us and pray for us. I mean, that's crazy. So that's when I said, forget it. I'm not going to do this anymore.
I know in your book, you write candidly about your daughter's cancer. I mean, candidly, to the point, as I mentioned, it brought me to tears on several occasions. It is a subject close to my heart. I really appreciated how you addressed not just cancer, but suffering. And that was part of your faith struggle. And you asked, I think, in my opinion, some powerful questions about suffering. I hope you don't mind, but I want to quote you for just a minute. Even the best thinkers of our time offered no satisfying answers as to why some people suffer in unimaginable ways while others do not. Why a rich man dies snug in his bed while thousands of African children starve slowly. Why millions of Jews were tortured and murdered. Why Erica, this is your daughter, suffered through intense chemotherapy treatments that left her with chronic physical ailments, panic attacks, and nightmares. Sorry, I'm getting emotional again. Looking like a TV ad for impoverished children while other kids played with their friends and ate dinner with their families. I can't imagine how difficult it is to write that honestly about something that painful.
It was painful. Now that you're reading that, it brings it all back because I don't understand that. And people would give me all the Christian platitudes. When I was in the hospital in Oakland, we were there for over a month with Erica for the initial part of her treatment. And it would be, oh, you know, the devil's just attacking you, or, you know, God's allowing this to strengthen you. And what God is this? What God is this? And that actually got me into looking at what God is this, you know, because no, I don't think that a woman who was dragged out of her home during the Holocaust and killed in a gas chamber is going to hell. I mean, is that's what the Christian belief? She didn't believe in Jesus. That's what would happen to her. And then, you know, there were certain passages in the Bible, I can't think of all of them, that really disturbed me. But so a guy who's carrying the Ark of the Covenant and he trips over a rock and then he's completely annihilated because he tripped and going to hell. I mean, that kind of thing, I just can't wrap my head around it. It doesn't make sense to me. To me, it is just cruelty.
I totally agree. Because as one who writes a lot about cancer, in fact, I have a new post that went live today called "It Matters How We Talk About Cancer." But I know those people who say this is God's punishment or this is God's way to test you. And those kinds of responses are not helpful either to the cancer patient or to the people who love a cancer patient.
It's like, really, because my daughter was five, what did she do?
Exactly.
What horrible thing did she do that would bring cancer upon her? And then if it's something I did, if it's something my husband did, well, you know, what kind of God would take out the punishment on the child? That was the other thing. It's sort of like Job. Oh, you know, Job, we're going to test you by killing all your kids.
Right.
That's great. But you know what? We'll make it up to you by giving you new kids. Now, what parent would say that other kids they had afterward would be the equivalent to the ones they lost?
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily a win.
Someone
there.
Killed my two daughters, and then oh, but look, you have here two other ones. That's not going to help. That's not going to make me feel better. Oh my gosh!
In the midst of your daughter's cancer and all that she went through, you decided to begin therapy yourself to deal with your anxiety and some of these things going on inside you, and you chose a form of therapy and went through a form of therapy that many from your religious background would at best consider unorthodox and more than likely would consider heretical.
Well, the crazy thing is I went to the therapist that my general practitioner advised me to go to. All she said was, here's a name. I like her. She communicates well. If you want to go to someone else, you can. And I had this number and I thought, oh, I really was not in a position to go searching around for a therapist and, oh, who takes my insurance and interview and all the things that they tell you to do when you're going into therapy. Well, sorry. I mean, I was holding on by a thread. I needed help and I needed it now. And I was having daily panic attacks. The anxiety never went away. I needed to talk to someone now. And when I went in, and this is Dr. Diana Wright, who is my therapist, who was my therapist then, still is. I mean, she has her doctorate. She's not some hack. She got her certification afterwards at the Harvard Mind Body Institute, which is where her techniques come from. So this isn't someone who's just totally off the rails. You know, she isn't dancing.
It's not like, you got her name out of the phone book.
Right, exactly.
Penny Saver Magazine, right. Therapy for Less.
I mean, I have heard some conservatives talk about who have read my book and then decide to bash me over it, talking about having described her as a sorceress. Like, we're up in the woods here, you know, around a campfire chanting. No, she has an office. She is a licensed therapist. She has her doctorate. Oh my gosh. That was one of my favorites, the sorceress comment.
But it is strange. I mean, you know, I'm reading it as a former fundamentalist, and when you go into your meditations and you're describing all of the things that you're seeing, it's hard for me to wrap my brain around it. And you and I have talked a lot because we're both very left-brained. So to kind of step out of that logic and look at the process that you went through is, I could see if I was still in that space where I think this sounds very demonic.
Well, the process though is straightforward. She gave me, you know, we were doing mindfulness meditations to begin with, which is well known to help with anxiety. And then she said, you know, I think there might be elements of PTSD that you're dealing with, although I never had that as a diagnosis. She gave me this Bell Ruth Knapperstack recording for people who are dealing with trauma. Now, the recordings of Bell Ruth Knapperstack, who is also a mental health professional, are used for the troops. And this exact recording is used to help the troops who come home with PTSD. So that's how mainstream it is. So I listened to this recording, and the point is just for me to follow it. And it goes into your outer heart, which is the damaged portion, into your inner heart, which can never be damaged. And that's the whole point. It's just to find a place in yourself that is healthy, that you can go to, that you can cling to in times when you're feeling upset, when you're having nightmares, whatever the case may be. And I found it very helpful that way. Now, what happened with me, though, is that I did diverge and I started having images come to me that weren't in the recording. So that's the part that seems weird to me. It seemed weird to me at the time. It seems weird to other people.
And did you write all of this down? Because your images are very vivid.
Yes, I wrote it down. I wrote them down. I probably did this meditation maybe 10 times. And then that's when my therapist said, you know, you really need to write these down. And I drew pictures. So I have drawings of all of them too. And the reason she had me drawing pictures is because the writing is my thing, just like it's your thing, you know? So she had me write a letter to my mother, you know, one of those letters that you write, but you never send. And then I read it to her and she said, well, what do you think about this? And I said, I think it's really well written. I said exactly what I wanted to say, and it came across perfectly. And she said, okay, I'm not going to have you write anymore. I'm going to have you draw pictures. And I can't draw at all. So that was a good route to go, because then I couldn't, you know, in the beginning, I was just judging my pictures. These look terrible, and they do look terrible, but that wasn't the point. And it actually would get me into a frame of mind where I wasn't judging.
How do you feel your relationship with your parents influenced your relationship or what you thought about God, especially as you got into the fundamentalist, more disciplined, black and white world?
Well, my dad was very passive, very quiet. My mom was the one who ruled the roost, and she was very demanding and very critical. So, of course, that's what I'm going to think. God is like that. I mean, it had nothing to do at that point with gender. I didn't think that God was passive, and well, maybe I did. But the predominant one was that it's demand, you know, God is demanding. You have to perform. You have to perform. It's always about performance, and you have to meet these expectations.
Yes.
So I would always think, you know, I have to do, what more can I do? And so it's no surprise that I would end up working in a political way that's also part of the religious right, because it's like, well, let me prove myself. And it isn't enough to just do something where you're affecting one person. You have to affect a bunch of people, and you have to affect the law of the land because you have to prove yourself.
And you were pretty young when you got recruited into the religious right. You talk about in your book. So that, I mean, that seems like just, you know, hearing your story about where you were in a very vulnerable position when you came in.
Well, I was in my 20s, and I had, you know, as Bill said, I had spent time in India studying comparative religion. And then I came back, and my best friend, who was a gay man named Ed, told me that he had AIDS. And I had told him before I left for India, whatever you do, because we're talking late 80s here, don't get AIDS. And then when I come back, he tells me he has AIDS. And that devastated me. I cried for days. And he said, well, I'm going to be here next Christmas and the Christmas after that and the Christmas after that, which was true, but he's not here now. And 17 of my friends, some close, some more distant, but 17 died before I was 30. And that has to change anyone, you know? So that is really what pushed me into the church. I was working with an evangelical Christian who would proselytize to me all the time, which drove me absolutely nuts. I mean, I just like, stop, I don't want to hear about the Bible anymore. But I went to church with him because I was feeling so unmoored. I just needed something. And I think, well, you know, that was kind of weak of me sometimes when I'm being very self-critical. Like, you just went into this without any sort of research. You didn't do your homework, nothing. But honestly, I really like, where can I fit in where I feel secure? Because I feel very insecure with all of my friends. Every time I turn a corner, another friend's sick and dying. And I spent, at the time, I was living with Mike and Ed, who both had AIDS, and caring for them when they weren't in the hospital. And that's, you know, when you're in your mid-20s, that is like a bucket of cold water in your face of reality. Most people who are that age are just, they're starting careers, they're still going out and having fun with their friends, and I'm dealing with death and dying. And obviously they are too. And I saw the fear, just the utter terror. I thought, this, you know, there has to be some sort of an explanation for this. And let me just say, I never thought AIDS was the punishment from God ever, even though I have been accused by that. And I never have once said that, and nor do I believe it.
Yeah, because it's very prominent in the circles that, that many of us traveled in. I know toward the end of your book, you write about something that many of us who came out of this fundamentalist background can understand and we can relate. So I'm going to quote you again. I couldn't be a representative of any cause when I didn't know what I believed anymore. And I certainly couldn't advocate for causes that twisted my soul into a gnarled mass of shame. I worried about what my life would be like if, as a middle-aged woman, I started all over from the beginning with half my life ahead of me and no idea how to fill it. My identity for nearly two decades had been that of a Christian leader and spokesperson. It's what moored me and kept me from drowning in the vast ocean of internal insecurity. Without it, what measure of success would I use to define myself? So you were concerned about what to do after your days in the spotlight. So
I'm still concerned about that.
What are you doing these days, and where did you end up in your faith journey?
I haven't really ended up anywhere. I think that is what's so crazy. It's like, no, I haven't ended up. I do have two teenage daughters, so they do take a lot of my time. So it would be hard for me to do, you know, much more than what I'm doing right now. But I think that is something that I've had to come to peace with and look and really look in myself and say, is that the measure of a successful life? Is the measure of a successful life being meeting the Western ideals of success, where you have a prestigious job of some sort, or you're doing something that puts you in the spotlight. Is that the measure of success? Because that's what I considered the measure of success before. And now,
oh, absolutely. Yes.
And now it's as if I have to fight against my culture to say, no, that's not what I believe is a success anymore. Someone asked me recently if I, now that I don't identify as a Christian anymore, if I think I'm a good person. And I thought, that is a strange thing. Yes, I do think that I'm a good person. And why do I think that? Because I support my family. I'm supportive of the people around me. I'm supportive of my friends. I think I'm a great friend to my friends. You know, I try to lift people up and not drag them down. So I consider that, I consider myself a good person because I do that. I consider myself a good person because the people around me are fulfilled being around me.
Mm-hmm. What did you do to find passion after that? I know that's a huge struggle. I mean, if, you know, whether you're sitting in the pew or you're a megachurch pastor, you leave and then you go, now what? You know, what do I do with my Sundays? You know, what was that journey like refinding a passion?
Well, I had always wanted to be a writer. And when I was in the church, you had to use all your gifts for the Lord. So I had friends, though, who were musicians who they just played in the church music group, who have since left and gone on to become fairly successful musicians, you know, secular musicians. So I kind of look at myself in the same way, that I really couldn't ever do the type of writing that I wanted to do when I was in the church, because any writing that I did had to be for the Lord in some way. So it's nice to be able to say, okay, what do I want to write about? I can write about whatever I want. And I think that's sort of a passion of mine. And that's where my passion is. My passion is to make sure my kids are doing okay. But in terms of, like, if you're talking about in the spiritual realm, I don't know. I mean, my passion would then be going out and hiking and just being around creation.
I love seeing all your pictures of hiking.
So does Tim.
Well, let me, you were talking about writing, being, and myself being a fiction writer, I can't leave without talking about your upcoming book, which is a novel. It's called The Cottage, A Novel of Transcendence. What can you tell us about it? I know authors don't like to give away too much, but what can you tell us?
Well, I would love to tell you the whole thing, but we'd be here for another hour. So I try to draw from my own experiences and the things that I haven't been able to put to write about in any other way. I decided to put them in this novel. So there's a young girl, her name's Nora, and she has hepatitis C. You don't know why she has it. You don't know how she got it. And how would a young girl get this? And the doctor tells her, sorry, the treatments aren't working anymore. So she has to decide what she's going to do. She's working at a shelter for women who have been beaten up by their partners. And she, one of the women that she works with, tells her, oh, I know this woman who is off in the woods, and you can, she does live in the woods, and she has helped a lot of people, and she does so in unorthodox ways. Let's go, and you should go and see if she can help you. And as she goes and she meets with this woman, she starts telling her story to the woman, and it ends up that Nora is a lesbian. It's nothing that she ever really accepted about herself, but it is one of the reasons that she fled and went to India. And this all comes out in the story. And then that's when you find out how she got Hep C, why she left, why it was so important for her to leave. And then the people she met. And one of the people that she meets there is a young boy who happens to be trans. And it's something that he doesn't really understand about himself either. and he's at a temple there being abused because he is more feminine. And then their lives come together in a very interesting way. And then...
And it's finished?
It's finished, yeah. I'm working on edits right now.
Oh, that's the fun part.
Yeah. Working on edits, which I've been working on for a while. It's very uninspiring.
No, it's not.
Yeah, that's when you start to hate your own work.
Exactly. Which is why I can only do a little bit at a time.
Right. I get that. Just to clear this up, because I know we've kind of hinted around, you were a lesbian, now you're in a heterosexual marriage. And I'm sure some of our listeners are thinking, what the hell? What's going on with this here? Can you kind of explain that journey and where you are with your sexuality?
I think it's interesting because I think female sexuality is so much different from male sexuality to begin with. And so men seem to be more, it seems to be more black and white. Well, when I was younger, I definitely described myself as a lesbian and had lesbian relationships, but I didn't have exclusive same-sex attractions. I had boyfriends along the way. So I would describe myself as basically bisexual. But even that kind of makes me laugh a little bit because I've been married so long. It seems as if without describing sexuality at all seems funny to me. As anyone who's been married for a couple decades would probably say, why is this even a topic? I'm just married to who I'm married to. And I think that's one of the problems with bisexual visibility is because you could end up in a heterosexual marriage like I do, and then people just think you're straight because that's how you appear.
Yeah. Right. Well, thanks for clearing that up because I know there's some confusion. And you're right. I think when it comes to bisexuality, that's something that we really don't understand. And we assume that if you're in a relationship with one gender, that you're having an affair with the other gender. And it just doesn't work that way at all.
And it's really kind of offensive. Why wouldn't I be faithful to my husband? Of course, I love my husband just like anyone else who's married to a spouse. Well, you would hope isn't going to go looking for someone else.
Bisexuality, because it's so misunderstood, is very convenient in the ex-gay world because someone can be attracted to the opposite gender and claim, I'm healed.
Exactly. And so that was the case with me. And then that made me perfect to be some sort of poster child for those who have actually been successful in their transition.
Yes.
Right. And so that's, because I've read about female sexuality and how it can change over the years. And that's dangerous also because I know plenty of women who are lesbians who are, they are not going to change. And there are plenty of women who I know who are heterosexuals who are, they're not going to add in another sexuality either. But there are some women who are more fluid. But that doesn't mean that it's all women. I think that needs to be stated.
I think we're learning more so than we knew when we were involved in the ex-gay world. Tim, I'm speaking for myself, not necessarily Tim, but that sexuality and gender is so much more complex than we once knew in our little black and white world.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. So it's hard to talk about in sound bites.
Oh, sure.
needs to be discussed at length. But yeah, I know women who were married to men, they just couldn't take it because they were lesbians. So it was just as a gay man married to a woman, they just have to get out. This is never going to be fulfilling. So I know with some of the studies that have come out on women, then I hear on the conservative side saying, if women's sexuality is fluid, then these lesbians, they can just get married to men and they're going to be okay. That's not how it works either. That's not what fluidity means. And it's not going to be the same for every woman.
And that's why I usually use the term complex because fluidity does play into sometimes the mindset. Well, if it's fluid, then we can change
right.
it.
Right.
Yes. Well, I am so glad that you were here with us and appreciate your time. I appreciate your honesty and transparency with us. It's been a pleasure to listen to you and hear the things that you've had to share with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's fun chatting with you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, we want to, again, plug your book. So Never Not Broken, which is available now. And then your new one is coming out.
Well, I don't know. In the next few months.
It's coming out
in the next few months.
Okay, but they can look you up on Amazon. So Yvette Cantu Schneider.
The book is available and I highly recommend it.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
I want to thank everybody for listening to this episode of Recovering from Religion podcast. If you have questions for either of us, if you have suggestions of a topic that maybe you think we should cover in the future, or if you think you might like to be one of our guests and tell your story, you can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks so much for joining us.